Baugh, it struck me as you're leading those songs that I think just about all of our holiday songs are 6-8, masquerading as 3-4, which makes leading them very fun. And I think just about everyone you had almost started on seeming like the fifth beat or the fourth beat of the. So you really pulled out all the stops to make a challenging song set. But they're beautiful. They're wonderful. I enjoy. As we're coming into the spring season and considering Passover and considering everything that's in front of us, we're singing about God's plan. We're singing about what He has for us to do. And I think on the Sabbath day, it is especially important for us to do that because weeks can be tough. Weeks can be very difficult. It was interesting. I was having a short conversation before services, and someone brought up, "Oh, I love the Sabbath. I'm looking forward to the Sabbath." Last week, Mr. Kiesel started off going like, "Okay, we had winter. Now it's time for spring." Because you get to the point, you're just like, oh, "I'm just, you need the breath, because the buoyancy that you get from the Sabbath, the buoyancy that you get from the holy days." We need it because it is just difficult. Have you ever been there where you've had that feeling where you're just like, oh, the Sabbath can't come soon enough on Monday? You ever have that? You're just like, it's just Monday. How is it this hard? For the time that we have to spend living in the world and what you'd say real life, right? The things that we have to do, the ins and outs of making our bills and visiting family who are sick, taking care of the various things that we have. It can be so overwhelming. And you layer on top of that all the various things and you're asking, well, how much time do we have left? Look at the world around us. Then you can really layer on a lot of things that are just heavy. And you can feel weighed down. Kind of like you ever watch those remodeling shows or something like that? Really old houses, and it's crumbling, and it's like the weight of time and the slate roof that was on top of it, and the ivy, all the things are kind of like bogging down the building. I mean, you're like, oh, that's gorgeous. And like, almost like, so growing up, and you get to go, we would drive through New England sometimes during the fall, going out towards we'd go to the Poconos, or maybe we'd go up to Canada for the feast, and so we'd go up along the eastern seaboard, and you have the older, more austere estates, and they always have ivy on them. We're like, oh, so ivy around the house sounds like it'd be a great idea. It's gorgeous. But you know what ivy does to your house? It has to stick its little roots into the mortar that's between the bricks. And over time, what happens, all those little roots that are holding it into place, they like to have water. And so the water goes there. And what does water do to the sanded mortar and the limestone? It just starts to decay it. So then you have to go back 50 years down the road. You have to re-tuck point the entire thing because all the mortar has fallen out. But they look absolutely gorgeous. It's just like you see these old boats. Actually, around this time of the year, you'll have this sort of thing where they'll take them off of the Illinois River. They'll take them out, and they'll start to put them into dry dock. They'll wrap them with that massive plastic wrap on them. And what they'll do with the boats is they will actually spray off the bottom with a power washer. So they clean them so there's no algae, there's no barnacles, there's nothing like causing decay on the bottom of the boat, just like you get the decay from the ivy. But they will do this with boats. And so every year, generally speaking, you have 1 to 2 haul outs a year on smaller boats. They don't haul out Navy boats and things like that. But smaller boats will haul them out. They'll clean them off to get all of the various things that might decay the wood or might get in there and cause waterlogging in the fiberglass. They'll replace anodes on metal boats because if you have an aluminum boat or something like that, they'll want to put a sacrificial piece on there so that it'll eat that instead of eating away the metal in the hull of the boat. So for bigger boats, though, that you can't haul out like that, like the Navy, you have to actually have specialists go down and take them off, take off the various things that are growing on it and causing decay on the boat. I don't know if there's anybody. I know that Mr. Graham was in the Navy, but the Navy actually estimates that you can lose about 20 to 60% of the ability of a boat to accelerate, maintain speed, its maneuverability, 20 to 60%, because you get the decay, you get the buildup, you get barnacles on the bottom of the boat. barnacles can actually comprise the structural integrity of the boat. Remember, we were talking about those various things that just weigh you down. They can compromise the structural integrity of the boat until there's nothing left, because they'll just eat at it. They suction onto it. It's talk about glue. Everybody wants glue to hold things together. What holds those barnacles onto the bottom of a boat is amazing. The Navy also estimates that barnacles will cost them approximately $1 billion annually. $1 billion annually in added fuel and maintenance costs. So when you ever go over the U.S. budget for what it is for the Navy, $1 billion just for barnacles. They both start with a B. I think it works there, right? There are actually over 1,000 different species of barnacles. I won't get into the specifics because it didn't interest me enough to look into it more, but 1,000 different species of barnacles. Talking about barnacles, though, because just like that, whether it's a barnacle or ivy or whatever, there are a lot of things that cause us drag. There are a lot of things that can weigh us down during the week. There are a lot of things that just add up. They can make us less structurally sound as Christians. They can diminish our spiritual zeal. They can diminish our ability to course correct, like the boat. You can't turn. You lose 20 to 60% of your ability to make a course correction because we have spiritual barnacles in place. In the end, if we're not careful, though, our own spiritual barnacles can actually cost us our admission, our entrance into the family of God. So today I want to talk about how we can go in there, whether it's with a pressure washer or a putty knife, scrape off some barnacles. I want to look at five individuals in Scripture. We'll kind of take their lessons and look at them. But first I'd like to start off in Hebrews chapter 12. I don't think we can talk about something that's causing drag on a boat without first turning to Hebrews chapter 12. Because it starts off in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1. It says, "Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses..." All these people who have finished. "Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. And let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." It's tough to do any kind of an endurance race. It's tough to do any kind of activity when you have unnecessary baggage. One of the things they do in racing, if you're racing and you're a really good racer, they want to equalize it. And so what do? They will make you put weight plates into your car in increments of 10, 20, 30, 40, up to 100 pounds. You'll be penalized because they want to make it even, right? And then the other thing they do is they try to they'll test cars in a wind tunnel to reduce all the drag you can possibly get off of the car, so its slipstream is going, it's going really well, and so then you're able to more efficiently get through the race. When you're running, you don't see people running the Boston Marathon wearing mukluks and a whole string of Carhartts and all their snow gear because it's heavy, it's difficult. I was a lifeguard for a little bit, and so I did the lifeguard class thing, and we had to do one session where we swam for 45 minutes straight doing laps in a pool, fully clothed. Oh, that was hard. And then we took off. It had to be a long sleeve, like a sweater and a pair of jeans. Took those off. I tell you what, I felt like grease lightning. I was like, how can you can swim all day like this? It's so fast. All of a sudden, the drag is gone. The soppy sweater that's going up over your arm. I mean, now you can move. Now you can do things. It's kind of like, actually, one of the individuals we'll look at. Let's actually turn there. Turn there first. 2 Samuel chapter 11. We're talking about David here. But in David's early life, if you recall, he wanted to go up against Goliath. And so what was offered to him by the king, Saul at the time, the king of Israel, says, okay, there's not many swords, there's not much armor in the kingdom, so here, take mine. Now, if you recall, Saul was head and shoulders above everyone. David was small and ruddy, so he was a young man, and it just didn't fit. Right? And so what did he end up doing? He set aside the armor that Saul gave him, took up his sling, he went and found 5 smooth stones, right? So the things that seemed like they were going to be there, he set that aside. And what did he go into battle with? 5 stones, and most importantly, God on his side. And he went in, devoid of all the baggage, all the weight, the things that just wouldn't work and fit for him at that moment, and he got rid of them. Now here later in life, we see a slightly different story. 2 Samuel chapter 11, we'll pick it up here. This is the story of David, Bathsheba, and Uriah. It happened in the spring of the year, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him, and all Israel, and he destroyed the people of Ammon, and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem. Then it happened one evening that David arose from his bed and walked on the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to behold. So David sent and inquired about the woman, and someone said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" And as you go through here, you go through this story. I don't want to read the whole story because it actually goes all the way on into chapter 12, which is where we'll pick it back up. But we see David here. He's not weighed down by the need to war himself. Because, I mean, he would go out in battle at times. And he was a man of war. That's why he was not allowed to build the temple, right, for God. And so he procured all the things for his son. But he wasn't going out to battle this time. So oftentimes the kings would go out to battle. But David was at a spot, he's like, let the young men fight. I can stay here. And so he stayed home. And then he sees Bathsheba. And as the story goes on, not only does he take another man's wife, commits adultery, he also then finds a way to cover it up, gets Uriah killed. And everybody knows what he's doing. It's like, are you sure? So like when he goes forward to fight, you guys all back up. And it wasn't just Uriah that died. He ended up having multiple people killed. So it would look like it was just a battle accident so that he could then keep the guy's wife. That's pretty dastardly. That's pretty low. And all of a sudden now, we don't have someone who's going into battle devoid of all of the trappings of man. We have someone who's, in that way, avoiding battle and then using battle to hide what he's doing. Chapter 12. The Lord then sent Nathan to David. And he said to him and said, "There were 2 men in one city, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had exceedingly many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb which he had bought and nourished. And it grew up together with him and with his children, and it ate his own food and drank from his own cup and lay in his bosom. And it was like a daughter to him. And a traveler came to the rich man who refused to take from his own flock and from his own herd to prepare one for the wayfaring man who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him." Before you go to verse 5, this kind of makes me think a little bit of Ahab wanting to have the field next to him. He's like, he's got all these other fields, but he wants that guy's field. I just wouldn't be happy until I have that guy's thing. And you're like, what a belligerent person. I can't believe Ahab was that bad and that Jezebel made that happen. Well, David did the same exact thing because human nature, because this is what we do. We get weighed down. We allow it to weigh us down, thinking that we're going through it. You know, it's all right. This is what I have to deal with. This is the cross that I'm having to bear. This is the difficulty in life. And so we can justify it. But David responds. He says, "His anger was greatly aroused against the man. He said to Nathan, 'As the Lord lives, the man who has done this shall surely die. And he shall restore 4-fold for the land because he did this thing and because he had no pity.' And Nathan said to David, 'You are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your keeping, and gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I also would have given you much more.'" As great as David was, God says, "I'd have given you more. "Why have you despised the commandment of the Lord to do evil in his sight? You have killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword. You have taken his wife to be your wife and have killed him with the sword of the people of Ammon." It's like you weren't even valiant enough to do it yourself. You used someone else to do your dirty work. "Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up adversity against you from your own house, and I will take your wives before your eyes, and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of the sun. For you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel, before the sun. See, there are costs to allowing the weight of life and the difficulty to overcome us. And David allowed that to happen. Let's turn to Mark chapter 10. Mark chapter 10. We see here another example of an individual. Mark chapter 10, verse 17. This is a parable that Jesus gave. Sorry, not a parable that he gave. This is an interaction he had. The young man, verse 17. As Jesus was going out on the road, one came running, knelt before him, and asked him, "Good teacher, what shall I do that I may inherit eternal life?" So Jesus said to him, "Why do you call me good? No one is good but one, that is God. You know the commandments." Talk about eternal life, we're talking about living our life in such a way that we can have that as the gift. It says, "Do not commit adultery, do not murder, do not steal, do not bear false witness, do not defraud, honor your father and your mother." The young man answered and said to him, "Teacher, all these things I have kept from my youth." And Jesus looked at him, loved him, and said, "One thing you lack. Go your way, sell whatever you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come, take up the cross and follow me." See, this young man was desirous. He's like, "You know what? I'd like to do an overhaul. I'd like to pull the boat out. I'd like to revitalize, renovate the entire chalet, the old house, the waste places. I want to rebuild this. I want this end result. How do I get that? I want to make sure that my boat can turn. I want to get all the barnacles off. What can I do?" And Jesus says, "One thing you lack. Sell all that you have. Sell what you have, give to the poor. You will have treasure in heaven, and then take up your cross. Take up the cross and follow me." But the young man was sad at this word and went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. So when he's given the opportunity to haul out, clear off the bottom of his boat, he says, "Ooh, that means I'm going to have to get off of the boat. That means it's going to cost some extra money to do that. That means, oh, how much does it cost to refacade an 1800s Victorian place that's got all the ivy over it? that's a hefty price. I don't think I want to do that. That's hard." And so he goes away sorrowful because that's just too much. Matthew chapter 13. Matthew chapter 13, verse 22. Jesus here is explaining the parable of the sower. And then towards the end of that, he says, "He who received the seed among the thorns is he who hears the word, and the cares of this world, the barnacles of life, the weight, the ivy, the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful. You have it in your sights." It's like, again, whether it's a boat or a house, you look at it and you're like, "Oh, I can see the end result. It's going to be gorgeous. You know what? I've got floor plans. I've redesigned this thing. It's going to be great." And you start down the road and you have not counted the cost. And you look at it and be like, "Ooh, didn't realize it was going to be this tough. Oh, I didn't realize it was going to be this hard. Not so excited about it anymore. About those projects that go over budget, over time." As Christians, we can look at things and you're like, "Ah, oh, I wanted to be baptized. I was gung-ho and I really wanted to go down this road. Now it's hard. Why is it this hard? Nobody told me it was going to be this hard. I didn't realize it. It's so lonely. It's so difficult. He was supposed to come 20 years ago. Why is this still going on? It gets tiring. And it's always going to be. And we're still left, no matter what, with the same question as the rich young man was. Are we going to clean off the boat or are we not? Let's go to Genesis chapter 4. Genesis chapter 4, a third individual. If you haven't already lost your spot, you might want to keep your finger there in Matthew chapter 13. We'll be back there. But Genesis chapter 4, another individual here. Genesis chapter 4, verse 1. Oh, in Exodus, that won't be right. Genesis chapter 4, verse 1. Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain and said, I've acquired a man from the Lord. And she bore again, and this time his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of the sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And it came in the process of time to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat, and the Lord respected Abel and his offering. But he did not respect Cain and his offering, and Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. So the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. See, Cain was looking at life, and it was hard. I mean, getting compared to your brother, and he's all right, but I'm not. Oh, come on. What else do I have to do? What am I missing? And Cain talked with Abel, verse 8, his brother, and it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. Cain allowed the weight of his sinful attitude to get the best of him. And God took him out. He said, you know what? I'm going to give you an opportunity. I understand you're frustrated. I'm going to tell you. I'm looking at it. I mean, I created your parents, designed you. I know how this works. I know how you guys are wired. So I see where this is going. Please rule over it. Don't allow this to come in. Sin is right there. Let's take the boat out of the water. Let's scrape the barnacles off. Let's pull all the ivy down. Let's get this thing brought back to the strength of its bones so that that way it doesn't decay. Let's rebuild it. Please, sin is at the door. Its desire is for you. Rule over it. Reset. But he didn't. He rose up and he killed his brother. Back in Matthew 13... Matthew chapter 13, verse 20. See here again in the parable of the sower. Matthew chapter 13, verse 20. It says, he who received the seed on stony places, this is he who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy, yet he has no root in himself, but endures only for a while. For when tribulation or persecution arises because of the word, immediately he stumbles. You think about this from Cain's perspective. I brought an offering. I'm doing what's right. What more do you want? How else am I supposed to serve you? He's doing what God told him. And so the persecution comes. It's like, oh, but you won't take mine. And immediately he stumbles. Falls on stony ground. Again, the heart of Cain was a heart of stone. It was not one that was going to be molded by God, even though God took the time to say, hey, warning, danger, Will Robinson, don't go down that path. Yet that's exactly where he went. He did not rule over the sin at his door, and it manifests itself as murder. And then, if you go on down, he didn't want to accept the correction that God gave him, or the consequences that God gave him. Let's turn out to Job chapter 41. Job 41. Another individual. Job chapter 41. If you read through the entirety of the book, what you will see is a man who is having a tough time in life, kind of like Cain, kind of like the young ruler. I'm doing what's right. I give offerings just in case my kids do something that's wrong. Why is this happening to me? Why am I enduring this difficult time? And you have all these chapters, all of these chapters. And here in chapter 41, finally we get to hear, actually not finally, but God responds to Job and he says, "Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook? Or snare his tongue with a line which you lower? Can you put a reed through his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many supplications to you? Will he speak softly to you? Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him as a servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird? Or will you leash him for your maidens? Will your companions make a banquet of him? Will they apportion him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle. Never do it again. Indeed, any hope of overcoming him is false." It's like, you can't even do this, Job. "Shall one not be overwhelmed at the sight of him? No one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand against me?" This is God talking to Job. "Who has preceded me that I should pay him? Everything under heaven is mine. I will not conceal his limbs, his mighty power, or his graceful proportions. Who can remove his outer coat? Who can approach him with a double bridle? Who can open the doors of his face with his terrible teeth all around? His rows of scales are his pride." God is taking the time to tell Job, newsflash, I made everything. I'm the parent. I'm in charge. And this is how it is. Going down to verse 42. Sorry, chapter 42. Job responds to God and says, "I know that you can do everything. I know that you can do everything and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You asked, 'Who is this who hides counsel without knowledge?' Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand. Things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, 'I will question you, and you shall answer me.' I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. For all of the righteousness that Job had, he also had things that were weighing him down." You see the attitude crop up of self-righteousness, of thinking that he knows better than the creator of everything. He had his own set of barnacles that were weighing him down, that did not allow him to turn and adjust and see what he needed to see until God took the opportunity to raise him up out of the water, scrape him off and say, "Hey, I can see them. I know that they're there. I know that they're bogging you down. Just as a reminder, you can't even handle this beast Leviathan. I'm the one who made him." And Job then does an about face. And he says, "You know what? I'm coming at you and I'm attacking you with unwise words, no counsel, no knowledge." He says, "I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you." How many times have we heard something said, "Ah, I'll believe it when I see it." Right? Kind of like Thomas. No. Kind of like the apostles? No. There's no way you could have seen him, ladies. Don't believe you. Until he appears in the room. Right? Then you believe it. As much, honestly, it wasn't too dissimilar from what Thomas did, only they got to see him first. They didn't believe the ladies when they gave the account. And Job says, "I heard about you. I heard about what you do. I heard about your plan," because Job understood God's plan. He said, "You know, I do want to have that change that's coming. We've learned about God. We know, at least in part, his plan. We live it every year as we go through the holy days. We're reminded of it. But isn't it time? Isn't it our age? Isn't it our knowledge? As we look at it and we say, oh. When we have the expectation of something happening at a certain time in a certain way and it does not occur, we can become like Job and we can start to question why it is that we're going through whatever it is that we're going through. Because, I mean, obviously, we know a thing or two. We've been doing this for, 30, 40, 50, 60 years, however long it's been. I'm sure God wouldn't have had it happen that way. That doesn't make sense. Why would he allow that to occur? Is that not the exact same thing, essentially, that Job was asking? We can even find ourselves getting to a point like David. It's like, well, I'm comfortable. I mean, I know I've got a special connection with God. I mean, I can see the blessings. I can see the evidence of him being there. And then, next thing you know, it's all right if I go take that other man's wife. I am the king. Wouldn't be in this position if I didn't have some of God's favor. And you can transition from just allowing a barnacle to partially affect you and the weight partially decay to where all of a sudden it costs you $1 billion a year. All of a sudden you've lost 60% of your mobility, your spiritual maneuverability. You're not recognizing how slow you're going. It's like, oh, this boat is really slow. How come I can't swim that fast? Well, it's because you have all of this baggage. You have all these barnacles, all these difficulties. Let's go back to 2 Samuel. Because Job saw, and because he relented in his argument with God, because he not only heard, but then also saw God, God also relented and blessed him in the latter part of his life. David here, as we read in 2 Samuel chapter 12, God says, I'm going to do this openly because of what you did. If you go down to verse 16. So God, as he said, struck the child of Bathsheba. And David therefore pleaded with God for the child. And David fasted and went in and lay all night on the ground. So the elder of his house arose and went to him to raise him up from that ground. But he would not, nor did he eat food with him. But on the seventh day it came to pass that the child died. And the servants of David were afraid to tell him that the child was dead. So David had the consequences for his behavior, for his actions. Again, just as Cain did, he had the consequences for his actions. But did Cain, what was Cain's response to those consequences? This is too great for me to bear. Let's ignore the fact that I killed my brother. This is too great for me to bear. David, the consequences are meted out. And what does he do? He's fasting and he's asking God, there's another way. And when it is apparent and clear that there is not another way, God is not going to allow for there to be another way because this is what the consequences are, then David stopped. He arose from the ground, verse 20, washed and anointed himself and changed his clothes. And he went into the house of the Lord and worshipped. Then he went to his own house. And when he requested, they set food before him and he ate. And his servant said to him, what is this that you have done? You fasted and wept for the child while he was alive. And when the child died, you arose and ate food. And David said, while the child was alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, who can tell whether the Lord will be gracious to me that the child may live? But now he is dead. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he shall not return to me. David recognized when Nathan brought it to him. He said, you are that man. He didn't say, oh, that punishment is too great for me to bear. He didn't start going to court with God like Job did. He didn't, like the rich young ruler, say, ooh, that's a steep price. He didn't, like Cain, allow his anger and his emotion to take over and rule over him that way. I'd like to read an excerpt from an article by Mr. Steve Myers titled Throw Off the Weight. He says, the novel Mysterious Island by Jules Verne tells the story of five men who escape a Civil War prison camp by hijacking a hot air balloon. As they rise into the air, they realize the wind is carrying them toward the ocean. They watch as their homeland disappears over the horizon. They wonder, how long can the balloon stay aloft? Hours pass by and the balloon starts to descend closer and closer to the ocean. There is no way to heat the air in a balloon, so they decide to cast overboard some of the weight. They reluctantly discard shoes, coats, and weapons and feel their balloon rise, but only temporarily. The unsettled aviators soon find themselves again getting dangerously close to the waves. Now they decide to toss their food overboard. They know it's better to be high and hungry than to drown on a full belly. Unfortunately, this too is only a short-lived solution, and the balloon once again threatens to dump the men in the sea. What can they do? One has an idea. They can cut away the basket beneath them, tie the ropes together, and sit on them. As they disconnect the basket, the very thing that they had been standing on, it drops into the ocean and the balloon rises. But soon the balloon again starts to descend dangerously near the water. At their final moment of despair, however, one man spots land. Not a moment too soon. As they approach the shore, the balloon now bumping across the waves, the men are so excited they jump into the water and swim to the welcoming beach. In this story, the five men were spared because they were able to let go of what would prevent them from staying alive. Mr. Myers goes on and says, in our case, we understand that we need to realize what the spiritual necessities in our lives are. He references Hebrews 12, verses 1 and 3. Let's turn back there. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1 and 3. We started there. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 3. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. We have those who have gone before us as luminaries, as examples, as motivation, to maintain our course, to maintain our speed, to be able to finish the race. How do you and I react when God shows us what weighs us down? How do we respond when we see the spiritual barnacles that are in our life? Do we act like the rich young ruler and just walk away? Do we respond like Cain and resist for a little while? Until you're just overcome with it and you have to kill your brother. And you give in. Do we react like Job and argue? Well, ultimately, we'll submit. But we're going to get a good argument in first. Do we react like David? And even though there are barnacles, and we all have them, when they're brought to us, immediately repent. We have all been called to a lifetime of overcoming. If you read through Revelation 2 and 3, what is it? It is all about those who overcome. Getting rid of the sin in our lives, the weight that burdens us. Let's go to Colossians chapter 3. Colossians chapter 3, verse 5. Tells us, therefore, put to death your members which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire and covetousness, which is idolatry. Because of these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience, in which you yourselves once walked when you lived in them. But now you yourselves are to put off all these: anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy language out of your mouth. Do not lie to one another, since you have put off the old man with his deeds and have put on the new man, who is renewed in knowledge according to the image of him who created him. This is what we're supposed to be doing, putting off that carnality. Ephesians 4, verses 17 through 24 tells us to put on the new man. Avoid what we once were. Ephesians 2, verses 1 to 3 tells us we were all once dead. conducting ourselves in the lust of the flesh. We were all at that point, the ship that's covered with barnacles on the bottom, we're all that romantic house that's got the ivy all over, but it's just crumbling and falling apart. It can look lovely, but you just wouldn't want to live there. It needs a lot of work. Our carnality, the things that we go through in life that pull us away from God, that on a Monday can make you say, I'm ready for the Sabbath already. Those are the things that are there that will weigh us down. They will divert our attention. They will take our focus off of God. And I'll tell you, it's difficult. It is difficult to have to, in this society, almost bifurcate our lives where we go through the week, and it is what we do during the week, and on the Sabbath, it's the Sabbath. It's great. And I'll tell you, it's a different feeling, and it's a struggle. It's a struggle when you have to kind of feel like you flip the switch from, well, there's weekday Nathan, and then there's Sabbath Nathan, or, you know, insert your name there. It's tough. It can feel disingenuous. But that's why I think God gives us an entire family here in the congregation, because when we're real with each other, we all know that that's how it is. It's a little bit opposite for me now, because it used to be, I would just get into the Sabbath and be like, I can finally take a breath. And so now it's the other way around, where, it's the Sabbath, there's a lot of stuff to do. So it's slightly different, but it's still one of those things where our task and our calling in this life is to meld the two. That we're going through the week without the barnacles, that when we're there on the Sabbath, you get them scraped off, and then we can go through a whole nother week. And we're there with each other. And there are things that, I mean, taking the house fixing sort of analogy, you know, you ask experts in the field and somebody else comes in and says, oh yeah, this is how you take care of that issue. This is how you fix the foundation. This is how you do these things. This is how you know, when I had barnacles, this is how I scraped them off. That's what we do on the Sabbath. That's what we do each week. That's what we do as we go through God's holy day plan, and we recover every year for a reason what God is doing as He's bringing us along in all these ways. Let's go to Luke chapter 6. When we're there, day in and day out, it is so easy to feel alone and isolated. And I know even during the week, like, my wife does homeschooling, she's taking care of kids, and I'm in my office, and I'm doing my stuff, and she's doing her things. You can still feel alone in a full house as you're trying to get things done that you need to get done. It is difficult when you feel alone. I would almost say it's nigh on impossible. Luke chapter 6, verse 46. There is no way we're going to make it on our own. It says, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do the things which I say? Whoever comes to me and hears my saying and does them, I will show you whom he is like. He is like a man building a house who dug deep and laid the foundation on the rock. And when the floods arose, the stream beat vehemently against that house and could not shake it, for it was founded on the rock. But he who heard and did nothing is like a man who built a house on the earth without a foundation, against which the stream beat vehemently, and immediately it fell, and the ruin of the house was great. We can't do it on our own. We have to do it. This life, getting rid of barnacles, getting rid of the sins that so easily ensnare us, anything that weighs us down in our walk, we have to do it firmly founded on God. Now, we can help each other. And that's why God put us together, is to help each other, to encourage each other. But it does not work without God as the foundation. It does not work without His keel guiding the boat. It doesn't work without Him. Let's close in Matthew chapter 11. Matthew chapter 11. As you consider Hebrews 12 and what we're told to do, to lay aside any weight. Matthew chapter 11, verse 28. Jesus calls people. He says, come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden. If you're feeling weighted down anytime during the week, anytime in your walk with God, if you're feeling weighed down, come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and I will find rest, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. It's not heavy. It's not weighty. It's about the heft of 5 smooth stones in a sling. It's about the right level of comfort for each and every one of us. He wants to guide us. He wants to direct us. We're all going to have our own trials. We're all going to have our own tribulations. It's nigh on impossible for us to fully empathize with one another as we go through the difficulties in life. But what we can do, without a doubt, is come together and to share, I was going through a tough time. Not the same sort of thing. But what is consistent is that I went to God and He helped bolster me. He propped me up. Chipped off those barnacles. Smooth sailing. Going straight. As we get ready, or as we're hopefully already preparing our minds to start this holy day season, let's make sure that we're casting aside the weights, that we're removing the barnacles that allow us to keep running the race that God has set before us.